OPM has tried on a number of occasions to modernize its technology for processing retirement claims, and you'll learn more about that, as I mentioned, later in the hour. Rick Holgate is Chief Information Officer at the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. Dan Chenick is Senior Fellow at the IBM Center for the Business of Government, and they are co-chairs of ACT-IAC, here to talk about the future of federal IT as agencies plan their IT futures for 2015. So there's good news today, gentlemen, that we appear to have at least a budget deal for the rest of fiscal 2015. So, Rick, you and your other colleagues in government, for the most part, some of our friends at DHS are still a little shaky, but other than that, have some budget certainty for the rest of this fiscal year. Not the way it should be. This should have happened a long time ago. But I imagine that will be a big boost as you and your peers in the CIO community try to figure out what now till September 30th looks like. Is that fair to say, Rick? Welcome. Thank you for coming in.
Oh, thanks for having me. Yeah, and absolutely. Having knowledge at this point in the fiscal year of what the rest of the fiscal year is going to look like is a positive. As you said, we'd always like to know it on October 1st, what our budget is. But, you know, at least it's only 2.5 months as opposed to 6 months delay in getting the year-end picture.
You know, the trend is in the right direction. Dan, planning-wise, though, what Rick and his colleagues are still stuck on is not having a really good idea what happens in the year or 2 years or 5 years from now, budget-wise. We know what the sequester numbers are, but they kind of went in the ash can when the Bipartisan Budget Act happened. So it strikes me that strategic thinking, I mean, I know people are still doing it, but doing it with any amount of certainty is still pretty precarious at this point, isn't it?
Yeah, a couple of thoughts. I think we have 2 more years left of the current administration and really 1 budget cycle, if you will, because the second cycle will be into the budget of the administration to follow. Mm-hmm. And so in any administration at this time, you tend to get less sort of big scale strategic and more sort of how does the administration institutionalize? And so from that perspective, this is not that unusual, not that much different from 1998 and 2006 in terms of the cycle. The planning and the cost of budget uncertainty is something that has real implications for agencies, whether it's this year in December or last year's, which were later. One of the reports that our center actually wrote a while back was on the cost of budget uncertainty, written by a professor at the University of Maryland, which outlines some of the considerations that agencies make, and it does add up. It does make a difference in terms of agencies being able to carry out their mission throughout the year.
Is that a message that you have much confidence is getting through to the people in Congress that matter when it comes to those kinds of things? Because I remember looking at that report, and some of the numbers that were presented there were, I mean, pretty eye-popping as far as the amount of money that just kind of goes out the window at a time that this budget turmoil is happening, supposedly because we need to cut back. That seems wasting money on planning for things that didn't happen or won't happen seems to be a good place to do it.
Yeah, one of the things that I think is important for groups like our association, the American Council for Technology and Industry Advisory Council, is to demonstrate that good planning has rewards, and it has rewards for the issues that Congress cares about, both appropriators and authorizers. And it has rewards for the American people and, of course, for the agencies that are implementing these programs and services. And that's why one of the priority areas that we have for the next year is around planning, management, and delivery of technology and how that technology serves. So the more that we can sort of repeat that message in forums and in discussions with the agencies and with leaders and staff on the Hill, I think the more that they'll understand that message.
Rick, you know I'm a big fan of the organization and the way that you're able to bring a lot of people together, very high-level people, both on the industry side and the agency side, to do the kind of planning and thinking and presentation of strategy that Dan just talked about. What are the other areas, in addition to the management delivery area, that you would like to see the group focus on?
Well, frankly, the other 3 priority areas that we've adopted in our strategic plan. So the second being secure sharing and safeguarding of information, which really gets to the cybersecurity issues and incorporating that principle into acquisition. And then second is digital government and innovation, which gets to helping to foster adoption of agile approaches and digital services and helping to institutionalize things like 18F at GSA and digital service within OMB. And then the third one is evolving the workforce, which gets to all these issues around improving the skills in our workforce, improving the incentive structure for our workforce, again, in industry and government, to make them more enthusiastic, frankly, about being a part of the workforce and more enabled in terms of the skills and the capabilities they bring to solving problems.
The strategy so far has been to develop these kind of pods of excellence, and you mentioned 18F and the digital services group at OMB. VA is developing one that Marina Martin is running, and there are others across government. What do you expect to see the connective tissue look like for these organizations so that they're not developing silos, which kind of defeats the whole purpose of promoting excellent digital government in the first place?
Well, and frankly, I think it's going to be the consequence of 18F and digital service, where they're intended to lower barriers among agencies, because they're intended to tackle problems in one agency and move to another and do it in a very rotational and almost agency agnostic fashion. And the other area I'd point to, or the other initiative I'd point to, is the Office of Federal Procurement Policy that just announced a digital acquisition professional program with the same principles of making it very collaborative, making it very cross-functional, not focusing on just contracting officers, but including program managers and others who have to be engaged in delivering solutions and really bringing them together to understand how to better do that business and do things agilely, and to do it in a way that again, is agency agnostic.
Is there a place in that conversation somewhere for somebody at least that represents the end users or the final internal customers of whatever the digital technology is going to be? And maybe it isn't even specific technology or specific acquisitions, but just some voice there for the rank and file non-technology person within the agency or an agency to be able to say, these are the kinds of things that will make our jobs easier.
Yeah, and I think that's inherently embedded in those initiatives of it really serving a customer in those agencies that has a sense of who they serve and what the need is and how to best meet that need. So mm-hmm. I think it's all in the interest of serving an agency customer.
Mm-hmm. I think if you look at actually the discipline of Agile and how it's developed over the last 10, 12 years, user scenarios are a key part of the success of that. Meaning, go to people that aren't the technologists, that are the users, talk to them about what it is they're trying to get done mm-hmm. with the technology, roll out functionality that can help solve their problem, and then unveil it sort of in small bite-sized chunks mm-hmm. so that they can see whether it works and then improve it and build on that.
Right.
At ACT IAC, one of the things that we'll be working on this year is trying to inculcate that and other elements of the digital playbook that OMB has issued that are consistent with our 7S for Success framework and other types of frameworks like that in terms of good planning for technology that I testified on last year, to try to work that through our various activities like the Management of Change conference coming up in the spring, like our professional development programs that Rick mentioned, and like our shared interest groups that do programming in various related areas.
The SIGs are doing some really interesting things, and one of the goals that I have for 2015 is to have some of them come in and talk about some of the things that they're doing, because it strikes me they're really, the folks do those because they take an interest in a particular topic, not because there's any potential gain for them. It's what they care about. And so they're really on the edge of what is happening inside the agencies and inside the companies that are involved in those things. The digital services concept will look like what, do you think, a year from now or 2 years from now within the government? Yeah, we've seen it kind of over the past year form and grow a little bit. And I wonder, we'll start with you, Rick, wonder what you think it will look like as we look back at this point in 2015.
Well, I think we'll certainly see more of a focus in that area and more of a nucleus of interest and enthusiasm for that approach. And I think what we'll also see over the next year is not shifting the focus, but I'll say focusing specifically on customer service and citizen services as a specific application of that capability and that discipline in improving the way we think about delivering services.
I've heard the term customer service over the past year more than I think I've heard it the entire other like 15 years that I've been covering the federal government, Dan. That can't be an accident.
Yeah, it's interesting because the National Performance Review in the 1990s had a very large emphasis on customer service around their initiative. So mm-hmm. it seems like we're in a 15 to 20 year refresh cycle. But that's correct. And I think it's really learning from industry and learning from some of the folks who have come in from industry to be leaders in agencies. And the fact that there's a laser focus on the customer in successful companies. And the realization that, especially in this digital era, you can use technology to accelerate that focus from programs in terms of how quickly they can get programs and services out to citizens, whether it's healthcare, education, even buying stuff from the government like the Mint, just using technology to really deliver services and create a better customer experience.
I love the term that you used to start your list, Rick, of the term secure sharing. And I want to talk about that when we come back and take a break. Dan Chenick and Rick Holgate here to talk about the future of technology and government on In Depth with Francis Rose. Be back in a moment on Federal News Radio. Thanks for listening to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, federalnewsradio.com. Rick Holgate and Dan Chenick of ACT IAC, my guests in the studio this afternoon, talking about the IT goals, predictions, trends for 2015. I mentioned secure sharing before we went to the break, Rick, and that sounds to me, it's not a buzzword yet, but it sounds to me like it could become one because it's two words that get right at the crux of what you and your colleagues in government are trying to figure out and what the industry folks that serve you are trying to figure out, and that's all about the data, the information that you want to exchange amongst yourselves within the agency and with other agencies, and not about the technology, the phones and all the gear anymore. And I wonder if we see more of that in 2015, if that might signal finally the transition to that worldview that we haven't seen in government for a long time.
Yeah, and I would say we would see that progress this year because, I mean, you know, there was a national strategy for information sharing and safeguarding a couple of years ago. And frankly, the momentum to pick up to actually implement that was relatively slow initially, and it didn't have a lot of visibility, even though we were supporting it behind the scenes mm-hmm. in terms of being on standards coordinating councils and supporting the whole standards-based acquisition philosophy to implement that. But even this year, the program manager for the information sharing environment has shown some specific examples of successful implementation of that approach. So, for example, federating access across multiple networks in law enforcement. And so Mike Howell, who's the deputy program manager and also on our executive committee, has expressed an interest in really digging into that and helping to move that further. So celebrate the success that they've shown already, but it'll help them promulgate that success into other areas to extend it into cybersecurity and adopt some of the same standards-based acquisition approaches.
I detect from that, Dan, I mentioned that transition that I'm seeing just in the terminology, but I detect also just from the conversations that I'm having with people that there is a shift underway that's a good thing as far as the way the government, I mean, maybe even the term cybersecurity won't be a term that we hear a lot in the coming year or years, because the idea of thinking about what we're protecting instead of just protecting this concept of a network might become passé in the not too distant future.
Right. It's actually another Back to the Future example, because we talked about information security 20 years ago.
Yeah.
And I do think that there's important sustainability of security and sharing. But people think about sharing, oh, that's open, I want to expose it, I want to get it out there. But in order to do that in a manner where you're getting the right information to the right people, and then you're also disclosing to a wider audience, even the general public, here's the threat, here's the way that you as a common user should react, and sort of understanding that distinction is a way to make sure that you are providing good levels of information security at the appropriate differentiation points mm-hmm. so that you get to folks who are regular users certain information, you get to law enforcement certain information, you get to system administrators certain information, and you can do that securely and create greater levels of security with greater amount of information on a need-to-know or need-to-share basis at each level.
Is there a way to build that mindset, that worldview, into the fabric of how an agency looks at information security? I'll use the old term, Dan. Or is that a case-by-case, person-by-person basis that's an ongoing education process, Rick?
I would say there's ways to build that into the agency culture. And frankly, we tried to do that after 9/11 and breaking down barriers to information sharing. And I'll say we made progress in that area to a certain point, and now we've revisited that through the national strategy and other types of initiatives to push the ball further in that regard.
Mm-hmm. What does that look like to you, Dan, that culture change that gets people off the focus on the stuff, the gear, and gets it on the information, both from a sharing perspective and from a security perspective. I have to make sure that if this person over here is not supposed to see it, that between me and you, that's still very secure, but we're able to do whatever we need to.
Right. Interestingly, the more comfortable people get and the more traffic that travels over cyberspace, there are just a greater amount of threats to that. Just, I'm going to draw a physical example. Just like when we drive to here, over to driving to the station, if you drove without traffic lights and without stop signs and without speed limits, you'd have a lot of dangers and a lot of threats.
It'd be a lot more fun.
It might be. We have developed over decades a set of rules and norms that are influenced by policy and law to govern and create safety in the drive from one place to another. We're still building those norms about how do you act at different levels. When do you drive fast? When do you drive slow? When do you share information broadly? When do you share it securely? What security parameters do you put around it? So how big is the stop sign, or how more properly probably how, what's the speed limit?
Mm-hmm.
You know, how slow do you really have to go to be safe? And it's important because in an environment where everything's online, there's a lot of activity and there are going to be potential hackers all over the place. And understanding sort of where making a risk-based decision about where to focus your energy, since there are going to be hackers in your network anyway, you know that, you got to create a resiliency strategy so that you can teach good cybersecurity practice at all levels.
But so to expand on your analogy, though, if we had a traffic light or a stop sign at every single intersection all four ways, that would wind up binding the system more than it would freeing the system and the information. So what do we have a sense yet of where that balance will be, or will we know it when we see it, do you think, Rick?
Yeah, I think it's a work in progress. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and again, as Dan said, I mean, one of the drivers of at least having to address that problem is the rapid evolution of technology, to include mobile technology and operating systems. And just that whole environment is evolving so fast that you can't keep up with a device-centric approach to things. You have to look at the entirety of devices, user behavior, and you have to look in terms of allowing access to that information, looking at, you know, things like the nature of the information, the nature of the person trying to access it, and the intent with which they're trying to access it. And looking at all three of those pieces of information to decide, do I allow that to happen?
The only one of your of ACT IAC's priorities for 2015 that we haven't talked about yet is the evolving workforce. And are there specific areas of the workforce that you want to look at, or do you want to look at it holistically? Emphases, what does that strategy look like, Dan?
So two parts. ACT IAC has long had a history of professional development programs.
Mm-hmm.
We have programs for entry level, mid-level, and sort of people that are entering the senior executive service where they learn from one another over the course of a year. We now have hundreds of people that have gone through those programs. We'll continue those, and then we're going to add a program at the senior SES level that's really fulfilling the promise that's been in various statutes like the E-Government Act around getting executives to exchange with one another, learn from one another over the course of a year. We're calling that the Champions Program. So we'll have a real professional development continuum across all stages of career. Secondly, the academy that ACT IAC set up last year provides a wide array of courses for people that want to learn about various topics in technology, and that will help to educate and improve workforce skills in a variety of areas.
And you'll also be doing a variety of other issues, I imagine. You have a special interest group on workforce development?
Human capital.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
HR.
That issue. And so we're looking, in addition to the formal programs we have around professional development, we're also looking at, for example, the Office of Federal Procurement Policy has recently announced an initiative around digital acquisition professionals and really help them think through how do we operationalize that? How do we turn that into a reality?
Mm-hmm. The evolving workforce issue, you mentioned the word incentives, Rick, when you first told me about that one. Where are the incentives now? And what work, what progress would you like to see made as far as shifting those, if that's necessary?
Well, I think it's the traditional incentives we've heard, which is to be risk averse.
Mm-hmm.
There's a natural inclination to be risk averse, to include any sort of creativity or pushing boundaries or exploring flexibilities and authorities or capabilities. And frankly, we've had that conversation with OMB to include Beth Cobert, Lisa Schlosser, and Anne Rong around how do we incentivize some greater flexibility in the workforce.
Mm-hmm. It will be interesting to see how that develops, because One thing that I'm detecting that I haven't seen for a while, I think, is an intersection now between HR people and IT people who are sitting together and talking together probably more than they ever have. Is that a fair observation, do you think, Dan?
I think that, and interesting, I think technology is actually helping to contribute to this sort of cross-functional contribution to the achievement of agency mission. No longer can you really have the HR silo, the finance silo, the IT silo, and the acquisition silo, and then they kind of come together loosely or ad hoc. You really have to bring them together more coherently around a program or a mission in order to achieve success, because all of those levers become critically important. And technology is kind of a common underpinning, because it's really how we deliver in the modern world, programs and services right to citizens in the way that they want it.
And I imagine it's more important than ever to bring all of those people together as early as possible in whatever process is developed, rather than saying, oh, yeah, by the way, we should probably get the finance guy in here to help with this. Right, Rick?
Yeah, and that's actually some of the philosophy that's embedded in the Digital Acquisition Professional initiative, is to bring in a cross-disciplinary team to work through how to be more agile, how to think more as a problem-solving team, and how to be as creative as possible in solving those problems.
We just have a couple of minutes left. We talked at the beginning of before we even went on the air, about some of the events that ACT-IAC does that are of great value to the community. You've mentioned the Acquisition Academy and the special interest groups and some of the other things. What do you think are going to be the most important vehicles among those to drive these conversations that we've talked about the time that you've been here, gentlemen?
So we'll have our major conferences next year, which includes Acquisition Excellence, which will feature a lot of challenges to basically say to the workforce, we have particular problems. Government leaders will say, we have particular problems. We want government industry to work together to help solve those problems. That'll be a very action-oriented, active type conference. We have Management of Change, which will be a very much of a 21st century technology expo. Sunny Hashmi and Kavita Kalator, the co-chairs, call it a hackathon type approach. We're really going to look at trying to drive a lot of conversations to really help move the government forward in ways that we started to do at the Executive Leadership Conference. And then the challenge will be, how do we bring all that together to create actionable outcomes that we can move forward?
Yeah, so I'd say, without being overly ambitious, all of those activities are going to collectively contribute to moving the ball forward. So, you know, the conferences will be a great opportunity to reflect on the progress we've made and the challenges we're still facing. But the shared interest groups, our professional development activities, will have an opportunity to carry those activities forward throughout the course of the year.
And Rick, is it true that you're going to be the government co-chair of ACT-IAC for the 17th year in a row this year?
No, there's no truth to that,
okay.
I'm afraid.
Okay, all right. Well, it's a rumor going around, so you better quash that. Gentlemen, thank you very much, both, for coming in today. It's great to talk to you as always, and congratulations on the great work that you're doing for ACT-IAC.